One, two, three, four.
I was very interested in the state of mind of an artist as he or she goes about making the thing. I think one of the things that artists do have, not just an interest in their own subconscious, but also an ability to find ways, tricks, hacks, all these sorts of things to get into their subconscious. And then over time, they understand how to make productive use of what they find there. We all have consciousnesses. We all dream. We all daydream. We all have kind of disassociated thoughts that float through our head, but we don't generally know what to do with them. And one of the traits that successful artists seem to have is this ability to cross borders into the recesses of their own heads.
Adam Moss was the editor of New York Magazine, The New York Times Magazine, and 7 Days. As editor of New York, he also oversaw the creation of 5 digital magazines, Vulture, The Cut, Daily Intelligence, Grub Street, and The Strategist. During his tenure, New York won 41 national magazine awards, including Magazine of the Year. He was an assistant managing editor of the New York Times, with oversight of the magazine, the book review, and the culture and style sections, as well as managing editor of Esquire. He was elected to the Magazine Editors Hall of Fame in 2019. He is the author of The Work of Art, How Something Comes from Nothing.
Adam Moss, welcome to The Creative Process.
Thank you so much. I'm very happy to be here.
Well, it feels odd to welcome you to The Creative Process because you've been living in it. You've been writing about it. So, but we're here to talk about, well, your body of works in journalism and editing. But we're here to talk about your book, The Work of Art, How Something Comes from Nothing. In a way, it's called The Work of Art, but just looking at it, it's a visual experience. It's a work of art itself. And it's more than a book on creativity in the way that it's laid out, because half of it is images, and then you have your voice largely in the footnotes and introductions. And then, of course, the voices of the various artists. And it has that flick factor as well, like a really beautiful magazine with the heft of a book, which makes it something you can return to, no matter how interesting the images are. And so in some art books, it's very much, oh, this is like every other book that the publisher publishes, but this is very much a work of art. And so tell us a little bit about the beginning of that process, about the architecture and the archaeology of the book, because these are not just finished artworks that you present.
Absolutely. In fact, there's very few finished artworks that I present, just basically to explain what they've done up to that point. I mean, there's a whole lot of reasons why I wrote the book, which are separate from the question about how the book is composed the way it is. But I've always been interested as a human and as a journalist in artifacts of the making of anything. I think that they're beautiful and extremely telling, that they provide a kind of map of, in the case of artists and the artist's mind, as they're making the thing, they're very honest. They're not distorted by memory and the other sorts of things that come when people try to make sense of what it is that they've done. I always love these. I love drafts of things. I love scribbles and doodles, outlines, crazy outlines, and lyric fragments on hotel stationery. I just love all that stuff. So when I got the idea to do this book, I thought it would be especially interesting if I could find as many of these artifacts as were available to me, basically presented them to the artists as a way to prompt their remembering about how to do this thing and explaining their thinking, their state of mind. I was very interested in the state of mind of an artist as he or she goes about making the thing. I've worked in magazines all my life. I'm really interested in the way that text interplays with images. And I always felt that books were a little antiquated in that regard, and that they had the quality that you're describing, which is that they look kind of alike and you have to go hunt for the images. And maybe sometimes the images are all grouped in the center. But in any case, there's a lack of dynamism. So when I wanted to do this book, one of my interests was to make a book that didn't look like any other book. Basically, then I worked with the designer and his team that I had worked with as a magazine editor, Luke Heyman and Pentagram. And I charged them with the idea of making a book that would sort of toggle easily between the imagery we were talking about and the words, my words, the words of the artists. I wanted to create a form where the artists were given room to talk themselves about what it is that they were doing. But then I created this kind of elaborate, almost Talmudic footnote structure so that I could talk without getting in their way. I could talk about what they were talking about and also lace in my own thoughts and fears and doubts and my own argument with them and my own little traces of my own memoir where they were relevant, because part of the book also, it's a kind of search book to try to understand why I was having so much trouble learning how to paint.
Yeah. It struck me as a kind of very complicated procrastination.
Yes, in a way it was.
Well, the very hard worker's procrastination.
That's really great. No, I hadn't thought of that, and that's absolutely true. I had years and years of experience with the magazine page, so I wanted to bring some of that energy into a book. That seemed interesting to me. So that's why the book is as weird as it is.
It goes beyond curation, like a curator of an exhibition. It's more like a curation of a group show. Right?
Yeah.
Like, you mentioned something there that you are providing materials, like cues to the artists, because some of these are like most well-known work or one of their well-known works, and they have to be reminded of how they did it.
Yeah.
And that like really rings true. Like when we are struggling with a work of art, we might know what we're doing or whatever it is. But when you're in the zone or whatever, you're in a trance state. People have described that to me where like they're jazz musicians improvising. So that's great. You show them the notes or the things that they've done in this state, and they're surprised at themselves.
Sometimes they have distorted, severely distorted, in their retelling of the story. They have actually gotten it wrong because they have created a more kind of pat narrative to describe what they thought that they were doing. And then when you present them with, I mean, there's a chapter on the poet Louise Glück, where she's very invested in the sort of protagonist of this poem called Song, and gave me a good 20-minute explanation of why the character was named what the character was, and had remembered it as being the character's name that came to her in a dream. And then I looked at her notes, and it was a completely different name. And so presenting her with that, it opened up doors. It was almost a little bit, I mean, a lot of these conversations took on some of the aspect of psychotherapy, where you would present them with things and then that would prod them to think harder and deeper about where their idea had actually come from.
Yeah, and so that makes sense. And you do address this fact that some people are superstitious. And then there are other artists, I think, that really do like to know where it comes from, because they're like, I'm going to go back to that shop again before all those supplies get bought.
Well, I mean, thank God. Otherwise, I wouldn't have had the book, because there were a number of people who turned me down saying, I don't talk about this.
They want to be mysterious, too.
And they want to be mysterious even to themselves. You know, and they don't want to consider it because they're afraid it's too fragile and that it will disappear.
So I'm really interested. I think that obviously the subconscious and the unconscious and where our dreams come from, they're all linked. Yesterday, I had a conversation with a neurologist who studies sleep and dreams and the human mind. And I think it's great when artists can have this, sometimes this wholesale kernel of like what it is or the potential, all the energy of what it should be. But I've been someone who was like, for better or worse, I remembered all my dreams obsessively to great detail. And I've always been told, it's a burden sometimes. Like I have to wake up to fall asleep, sort of.
I understand.
It's exhausting. These sleep experts have said, oh, it's because you are unsettled and you woke up many times. And I never feel that. I feel like I hope that with artists, like maybe it's you're finding a way that you get fascinated by your own mind. And I'm hoping it's not that I'm chronically sleep deprived, because it seems like a bad
thing. Yeah, that's a bad thing. Bad. There are drugs to help you with that.
Yeah, and also others find creativity through drugs and all this. So you discuss the tricks, right? The ways that we get into that state.
Yes. I think one of the things that artists do have, not just an interest in their own subconscious, but also an ability to find ways, tricks, hacks, all these sorts of things to get into their subconscious. And then over time, they understand how to make productive use of what they find there. We all have consciousnesses. We all dream. We all daydream. We all have kind of disassociated thoughts that float through our head, but we don't generally know what to do with them. And one of the traits that successful artists seem to have is this ability to cross borders into the recesses of their own heads. Pretty impressive.
Yeah, and to kind of speak in tongues or kind of have a I don't want to say multiple personality disorder, but you have to be the creator, and then you have to then put on the editor's hat, and they're like, is this good? Do we keep this? Do we go?
Absolutely. I think multiple personalities is a terrific way to describe it, actually, because I mean, Tony Kushner, the playwright, also in the book, kept talking about what his subconscious was doing was laying breadcrumbs, which his sort of conscious self would go about collecting and make sense of. So it's almost like there's this show on Apple television called Severed, which is a kind of big thing here in the United States, about this kind of science fiction method by which you divide your innie and your outie, and you send your innie to work, and your outie is out of work, and neither side knows what the other one is doing. So they're a sort of severed personality, and it leads to all sorts of diabolical things, which whatever. But that basic thing about having two personalities, an inside and outside, is actually not a terrible way to describe the way that artists, when they're working well, work.
Yeah, and then to be in it and outside of it is really important. And I want to talk about AI because it has such implications. But I fear now, initially we thought it was going to do all the grunt work. And now it feels like we're kind of giving it the creative work. So we're giving it the innie work as well. Which was like, that's supposed to be our domain. That to keep some of this for ourselves. Let's just talk about some of the different arts. Now, there's a division of the different kinds. You mentioned, like, there's writers. So you've gone from the magazine world where you've worked with writers, but you've worked in this collaborative space.
Yep.
The people that you write about, you have a kind of balance between the visual artists, the writers who are working on their own, and some who are working, say, on a television show like David Simon, The Wire, and are working on, you know, jokes, and you like this really interesting architecture of a joke, you know, for television, that kind of thing. And so did you try to keep that balance between the collective, or was it just ones that just resonated with you?
Well, the collective ones are, they're less present in the book. There's a few of them. David Simon is one of them. Also, the other television person, David Mandel, on writing in jokes for the show Veep. But for the most part, these were artists who worked alone, whether they're visual artists, sculptors, painters, etc., or their playwrights sitting in their room alone, or novelists or songwriters who are at first working by themselves and then it becomes subject to a sort of cooperative process. I was most interested in the way that people work alone because it was the thing that I had so much trouble with. As you said, my whole experience as an editor and in a way doing creative work was in a group and the way that a group functioned. And I felt like, you know, I understood that better than I understood the ways in which one talks to oneself as an artist. And so that was what, to the extent that the book was trying to discover and understand something I didn't grok at all, it was to try to get into the artist's mind as they were functioning as the group all by themselves. You know, that they were every character. And that was fascinating to me. And I wanted to decipher what it was that they did when they sat in a room and allowed their mind to go free and allowed this dialogue to happen. There's a lot of evidence in the book of the way that people have internal dialogues as the way to make what they're making. And that was wonderful and incomprehensible to me as I started.
Yeah, and it's really interesting that the moment when you're alone or when time is just disappearing or you're going into this kind of trance, and you do highlight that, even though I do consider, it's not an equal balance, but I do consider a number of the artists to be both collective and more solo artists, but you focus on that period where they were the beginning of the project before they get their whole team.
Yeah, or, I mean, there are chapters, as you, David Simon, where something happens by himself, and then it's subject to a completely other inquiry, which happens. In David Simon's case, there was this wonderful phrase called the bounce that came up, which is how creativity works, is the way a way a ball might bounce in a group. It bounces from one person to another, and then they bounce it back, and it achieves more velocity when more hands are on it, and the bounce has a life of its own. I absolutely related to that. As a creator, the bounce in one's own brain was the trickiest aspect. I could have written a whole book about collaboration and about collaborative making. And that's a book that somebody should write, not me, but it's fascinating as well. But this book was really mostly about what happens when you sit in a room by yourself.
Yeah, because to have something from nothing and that stage. Mm-hmm. The first cells, that's like two cells, four cells, when it's getting its energy. It's true, because even like Sofia Coppola, filmmaker, you're talking about Lost in Translation, which is also itself a, f- a film, I think, in part about loneliness.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah.
Like isolation. And so that's fascinating how things that happen to her, also the kind of serendipity or the Dada thing of your life just intruding, like she broke her, her toe and stuff in the film.
Yes.
And so that's the real human moments, the flaws that I think makes art or human-made art.
I'm with you.
AI can appreciate its own other art. So you really were finding yourself as a writer. You have an illustrious career as an editor, but a lot of editors have made their way to editing through writing, but primarily you focus on magazines as an art form. In the New York Times magazines, New York Magazine, I mean, won these awards. And this is your first book, as you say. I really like that it had that energy of dialogue, because this is also seems very important about the creative process or the work of art. It does, even if it's a lonely process, you say you're having a conversation with yourself. There has to be that feeling of conversation. Otherwise, it's a lonely work.
I agree with you. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I kind of ran away from writing my whole career, mostly because I was a little bit terrified of the sitting in a room by yourself thing, the little monsters that come out in your head when you're alone, or something that I tried to avoid. And then when I struggled with trying to learn how to paint, and I looked for a book like this, it didn't exist. And so I decided, okay, I'll write it. And I was very scared of that because I was scared of the writing of it. I constructed the book so that I would recreate a group process. The artists would be my collaborators. I would talk to them and present their own work in the same way that I was, as an editor, presenting the work of writers. And then I would intrude in a more transparent way than you can in a magazine. That, in the end, worked out. I was the interviewer. I was the composer of the various images. All the magazine parts I did all by myself. So that was a very different kind of experience for me.
And you're right. There are books on creativity, but they tend to take the wisdom out. They just draw it from wherever.
Yeah.
They didn't meet you. And so it becomes kind of like a formula. This is what you have to do to be creative, as though there is just one route.
Well, there's two types, I find, of a lot of creative books. And they're both valuable. But one of them is where the writer is trying to encourage you to tap into your own creativity. They're kind of self-help books. There's a big, big tradition of those. That's all great. It's great to tap into your own creativity. But what happens once you have tapped into your mind that way was an unwritten story. Once that happens and then you're trying to make the thing, that was something that I didn't really see. I see craft books. And I see tapping into your subconscious to be creative kind of books. But this whole vast world of the middle, which is how you create a strategy and how your mind goes through various phases on its way to making the thing, the interior of the artist's mind was a place that books didn't really know how to visit, and I could figure out a way to do it myself. So that was one kind of book. The other kind of book is, you know, artists develop a kind of, they have a spiel.
Yeah.
In order to describe what it is that they've already made. And so that too wasn't satisfying to what I wanted. It was almost like I wanted to be in one of those movies where you're inside someone's brain. I literally wanted to be inside someone's brain. And so I tried to figure out a way to do that in a book form.
Yeah, I understand that desire to be inside someone's brain, to not just describe the work from the outside, but to somehow, wanting to step inside the mental and emotional space where it was all created. And in a way, experiencing the work itself is like the first step inside. But you're right, it's not quite enough. And as much as our project is called The Creative Process, I rarely ask artists, what's your process? Because as you said, people can often become self-conscious. They freeze up, or it's just subconscious that putting it into words almost distorts it. And so instead it's revealed a little more organically, through hearing about their life, their interests, their politics, where they're from. You kind of begin to understand not just what they made, but why they made it, and can then trace the creative logic back to its source. But you almost have to live alongside them, or as you said, be invited in at those raw moments.
Sometimes, I guess that they said, say if they're like relationship therapists, or say, call us up when you're like having an argument.
Yes, exactly. At that moment. Also, it's very, very hard thing to capture, even if you're making a documentary or something. There was a kind of famous documentary that played a role in this book, which was Peter Jackson's reconstruction of the making of the album Let It Be. The Beatles album. And there's a moment, just a very fast moment in the documentary where Paul McCartney has a guitar and he's just riffing on the guitar and you hear the first chords of the song Get Back. And it's just amazing because you actually see the moment of emergence of a particular work that you know. And it feels miraculous, but of course it isn't miraculous. Nothing is really miraculous. Everything has a reason. Everything comes from somewhere. So that's, anyway, that was the project of the book.
Yeah, and I think everything comes from somewhere. And you've seen it emerge and also beyond this, because obviously you know many artists and have worked for many writers over the years. So that selection process, of course, is difficult in itself. But there's a certain kind of, and I don't know if you can answer it, but there are certain personality types that go to these different vocations. I think one is the kind of stubbornness.
No, stubborn persistence, I would call it. Yeah. You know, they struggle, but they have an amazing capacity to keep going in spite of their own distress as they're making the thing. Most people give up. And one definite mark of an artist who succeeds is their ability to persevere.
Yeah, I think that's true. Perseverance furthers, as they say. Another thing I think about is about the arts. There are some who feel that they have to find or learn about creativity, and there are others who are freewheeling, and they let the idea come to them in an organic way. And, you know, many creatives often say, I didn't write those songs, they came to me. Or we hear this from people like Bob Dylan or the late Leonard Cohen and a number of artists. It seems like creativity flows through them and not from them. And they speak of a kind of channeling that takes place, something that they can tap into. Then there's this other side of creatives who have this lot of rituals and formulas and a more studied approach.
You know, that's how they learn about the world. They like to categorize it. This is how it is. And then I think with artists, it's a kind of caring, maybe not always about the people in their immediate life, but caring that each individual story and life like means something. And
yeah.
The work of art. It's also kind of a tasting plate for different creative professions. Because yeah. I think that there are a lot of people, oh, like, I want to do something creative. I have this sort of skill. I have a bit of this and that. So it's a tasting plate that we could understand what it is to live that life, because it can be a hard, long road.
Yeah.
Were there, in these conversations and the writing of the book, were there other professions like, oh, I didn't even know, oh, fashion design. You know, like, I actually know a little bit about this through my, and then, were there things that, you know, did you kind of like, I would like to try that?
Well, I mean, there were certain things that I came, like the David Simon chapter is in there really because I'd always wanted to make TV. You know, David Simon also came out of journalism, and then he was this amazing television storyteller. And so a lot of the book was fueled by my own envy, and his career was one that I absolutely envied. No, I mean, food makers are in there because I was interested to see whether the invention of a dish or something like that was analogous to the writing of a poem or the writing of a joke or the making of a painting. I was extremely curious about how you make a sculpture like Kara Walker, who's the first chapter in the book, does with this incredible sugar sculpture she made. You know, very interested in that same way about how a computer can sort of screw around. You can use it as a tool to make art. There's like a sandcastle builder in this book because it seemed interesting to me. I mean, I saw someone I knew well, and he was making these incredible sand castles that he showed me on his phone, and I just became fascinated with making something so ambitious. These were not little sand castles, these were giant architectural wonders that was meant to perish at the end of the day. I mean, that's the thing about it, a sand castle. So there were certain curiosities that I had about the way that art works that played out in my selection of the people I wanted to talk to. And some of the people I wanted to talk to were people whose work I really admired. Some of them were people whose paths just seemed interesting to me. And some of them were like, I went to talk to Gay Talese because I wanted to understand how literary nonfiction, a cousin to the journalism I had worked with in my career, worked. And I wanted to, I had a kind of secret agenda to elevate certain kinds of journalism to the same consideration as art as in other fields. But anyway, yeah, so the book is quite eclectic and I hope is more interesting because of that.
I think so. I think it works as a kind of, like, they could have feel like they're in conversation with each other, mm-hmm. or a great dinner party.
Yeah.
That we're like, oh, and I, what's she have to say? And I really do like that. And I want to talk also about how you came up in journalism and to this golden age of journalism and magazines. I mean, yeah, that was the print era and that we should really talk about. But I do want to talk about elevating, because people don't think as often, of course, there's the star editors. You're a star editor, but still humble. Curators, film editors, theater directors, you still feel like they're an author. But I feel like these are all related in terms of getting the energy and a look and a feel, and that we should honor them. There's so many behind the scenes people. In fact, there's usually more behind the scenes people than there are in the front. You tell us about how you came up in editing, your mentors along the way, and how did you know that was a place for you?
Well, like most people of my generation, I think people understand it better now. But when I was growing up, I didn't know what an editor was. There were no such models for that. But I was extremely attracted to the magazine form when I was a kid. I lived in the suburbs, and the magazines were my ticket to the kind of sophistication of adult city life. I used them. I would just immerse myself in them as a very young child and became attached to them as a portal to a world that I wanted to belong to. So when I graduated college, I tried to find a job in magazines, and for various happenstances, managed to get one. I tried to be a writer like everyone tries to be a writer, because that's what seems to be the only thing you do in that. And I suffered for it. I mean, I was lonely. And I looked and I noticed that there were all these people who were actually doing something that was much more interesting to me, which was that they were behind the scenes, but they were also imposing on this periodical form, this thing that appeared and then appeared and then appeared, making this thing. It just felt like the kindergarten projects that I had been doing as a child. It just seemed like fun. And I learned, once I was transferred to the role of a young editor, just how creative those positions can be. You come up with the ideas, find the right person to do the ideas, figure out how to tell the story. If you're the head editor, you basically figure out what the personality. You are the guiding spirit of the magazine. And that was something that I aspired to do. That's what I wanted to do. It was the great era of print, the last great era of print when I was coming up in magazines. But then as soon as it also became digital and the digital looked like its future, I became quite entranced with the possibilities of digital journalism. They seemed just as creative to me. The sort of last big chunk of my career was figuring out how to translate the values of print magazines into a world of animation and sound and graphic and interactive storytelling. That was amazing. I was very lucky to have been a magazine editor and to sort of traverse these two eras of it during the last, whatever, half century.
Yeah, and I think it's really a beautiful art form in that for anyone who's like really curious and loves learning, it's an art form of visual delights, but you're learning all the time.
And the best thing about it is that it's periodical, so you just do it. You're not overly fussy about it necessarily. You try to do an amazing thing, but then you have an opportunity to do it all over again and all over again and all over again. So you're constantly learning and you're constantly goaded into trying new things, which is a very exciting, creative spur.
Yeah, I think it's a living art, and I can see also why you're attracted to television, because that has the same like slow germination of film, and then you have to get the funding and things. But once you're in television or whatever, there is this thing that you have to get
doing a deadline. Yeah. It's just, and it just ends, and then you get to do it again. That's to me a great thing. One of the frustrating things about writing a book is that I spent, you know, almost 4 years doing this book. And then it exists. It's fantastic. It has a nice physical form and everything. But you don't have an opportunity to do it again. I realized, of course, after I finished the book, how many things I would do differently if I was to do the book all over again. And magazines give you that ability. And books, they have their own delight. But they're a different thing.
Well, particularly in the digital form now of magazines, where you can have the hyperlinks or you can make your corrections very
much more
cheaply as well.
Yes, that's true.
It is actually sad the way a lot of journalism is going now. The fact the lies are for free and the truth is behind a paywall, which we should pay for good journalism, long form journalism or dedicated journalism, people who are committed to telling the truth and not only opinions. There's a place for that. But, you know, there are certain things that are facts. Are you glad to be out of the game? And what are your thoughts on how can we, beyond buying news, what can we do? Because it threatens our democracy and so many other things. It threatens civil discourse.
I think that the business model of magazines took a beating. at least here in the United States, it really had to do with the fact that magazines were almost completely dependent on advertising. And then when advertisers found different ways to reach people, magazines were kind of left without any way to support themselves. So yes, paywalls and other ways where they asked readers who had been subsidized for years by advertisers, asked them to pay the freight. It's unfortunate, although I think the transition has more or less worked in their magazines. Some kind of digital journalism is able to sustain itself through subscriptions. That's good. But the bigger question you're asking is about truth and how magazines can perform in an age of competing realities, let's just say, and competing versions of truth. And also the way that the internet works for digital magazines, where people only surround themselves with their own perspective. There's not a lot to understand how other people think. And that all said, I think that there are journalistic outlets, my old haunting ground, the New York Times,
sure,
which has done as good a job as you can think of to exist as a place where a kind of objective reality is at least pursued, not always achieved, but being extremely nimble in figuring out how people take in information and being very creative in how to reach people. That's impressive. Yeah, I'm not particularly nostalgic for the old forms of journalism. I find myself interested in all the things that journalism becomes on its way to the next thing. But of course, the world we live in is very challenging. And I'm not sure that journalism is the answer to the challenges that we have. It's helpful as a tool, but there's something much more seriously complicated going on.
Yeah, Nicholas Kristof told me that more journalists had lost their jobs in the last decade than coal miners. These jobs are really gone out the door. More journalists have lost their lives. So it's finding ways or like being creative. You're a journalist and then you have a job to support your journalism.
Yeah.
I'm Peyton Desjardins, a student at UC Berkeley studying journalism, and I'm collaborating with the creative process. I'm excited to work on this episode because Mr. Moss has an incredible fascination with the process of artistic endeavors. His ability to reimagine editing and journalism as an art form and investigate how the best of the best go about their job is a wonderful deep dive into the psychology that backs artistic production. His comments regarding the failing business model of the journalism and magazine industries is incredibly striking as we see the downfall of many local news organizations in addition to majored ones like the LA Times. As local news organizations continue to lose money and shut down, many areas are left without any sort of local news coverage. The digitization of news has changed the way revenue is made for news. Digital ads do not make the same money print ads did, which is resulting in major layoffs, cutting of coverage, and overall unstable careers for journalists. While individual subscriptions and easy accessibility online help bring in profit, the reliance on advertisement and news is significant and largely unsustainable. This is a problem that must be rectified by industry leaders in order to keep the journalism industry afloat. And now back to the interview.
So magazines are so visual, but what drew you to go to painting after being so much a person of the word?
One of the things that's great about magazines, or at least the kind of magazines that I worked at, were that they told their stories as much through imagery as that they did through language. And I always was especially drawn to the image aspect of magazine making and the way that a picture or graphic or a piece of visual information can tell a story. So one day, I have a house in Cape Cod that used to be an art school, and it's kind of inhabited by ghosts of the old artists. And one day I just decided, without having any background in art at all, that I would try to take advantage of the ghosts and paint. So I painted a painting a day. And that was a humbling and learning experience, but I really enjoyed it. And I came back to New York and decided to paint more seriously, although I still had this job as an editor, which was more than a full-time job. And then I finally quit my job, and then I decided to try to paint full-time until I wrote this book, procrastinated, as you said. So that's how I got into painting, and then I got some skills training, and I took classes and that kind of thing. But basically, I just found the act of putting paint on a canvas to be enormously satisfying, even if it frustrated me to no end. Wasn't good at it.
Well, you say wasn't. You're still painting.
I am, and I'm still not very good at it. But one of the things the book taught me was that nobody really is fully satisfied with anything that they do. And there was a refrain in these conversations I had with artists where I would ask them to exalt at the making of the thing that they that we've just been talking about. I kind of wanted a happy ending. I wanted an ending to like, oh my God, and I figured it out and bam, fireworks. I made this great thing. I never got that. I never got that sense of closure or epiphany or catharsis in the making of the work. What I got was that the next day, I said, yeah, I was fine. And then the next day I went back to work. And what really consumed me was the making, not the thing that I made. I resisted that for a long time. And then I found that to be unbelievably liberating. So that I go into a painting studio right now and I just find the act of making so deeply moving to me that I care less. I can't say that I don't care at all, but I care less about what it is that I've made and more about the feeling making it.
That's a really beautiful and healthy way, and particularly for the performing arts or the ephemeral arts, because I know like there's Trilla Tharp and different, you talked about food arts, and they have to accept that there's going to be, not flaws, but there's going to be something human.
Yeah.
It's not going to be the painting of all time, the masterwork. Obviously, we are both interested in how the creative mind, the dreaming mind works, in whether it's Kintsugi, where there's the flaw, the golden flaw that helps us understand, that gives us that way in, or just something that shows the creative process of it, I am always drawn to it more. So the idea of a perfect painting, it's kind of dead to me. I don't know if
you feel also that. Vulnerability is what's interesting always. Yeah. It's interesting in all the arts, and it's interesting in the making of the arts. It's like you want to see the pain. You want to feel the human in anything that you take in, a song, a painting, a book.
So I don't know if you still keep painting a day.
No, I don't do that anymore. Although I am doing this new project. It's fun. I mean, interesting, scary. I read the New York Times in print every day. And, you know, I'm in a state of constant outrage, not at the New York Times, but about what
harness
it's...
Harness that energy.
What it's, yes. And so then I take the physical newspaper and I just paint on it every day. And I paint on something from the newspaper that has moved me to some action.
Call them your blue pencil paintings.
Well, I paint portraits on them, and I paint symbols and marks and expletives and all sorts of things on oil paint on the canvas of the paper itself. That's so that I now have 60 pages of...
So you're collaborating.
I guess so, yeah. It's my own silent collaboration with the world.
Yeah, so it is. It becomes a kind of diary, which I also love. It's those works of arts that feel like, here, it's kind of conspiratorial. It's your letters to the editor, I guess.
Yeah, in a way. Yes.
Hey, Peyton, is there a particular chapter that you enjoyed that you'd like to ask Adam about?
I was most interested in Sofia Coppola. The film process is such a long and grueling, like there's so many different components, so many different people you're working with. I was curious on how you were able to get into the different parts of her specific process, considering that there's so many people that she has to collaborate with to kind of get the final product.
Well, she's a beautiful filmmaker, but I also feel that she's actually quite a great film writer. So my main focus was on the writing of the script, which is, in her case, I mean, in some cases, they're quite collaborative, the writing of scripts, and they go through rewrites and have different writers and all of that sort of thing. But in her case, she's a kind of auteur, and she writes these things all by herself in a room. It did kind of resemble the other art forms I was talking about. It was the pre-collaboration, in a sense. And in her case, it was really the chapter on Lost in Translation that I have in the book is really also about Marie Antoinette. She was writing two movies at the same time. She toggled back and forth, and they informed the way that the other was written. She's just a very thoughtful person, and in some ways, just very forthright. So, yeah, I love that chapter, too. We had talked before, Mia was talking about, I just love this moment. She can't figure out what to do next in the writing of The Lost in Translation, and she breaks her toe. And she just decides to have her main character, the Scarlett Johansson character, break her toe. And if you see the movie, if you read the script, you see that that completely changes the movie. It changes the trajectory of the whole shebang. And that just came from her own experience and figuring, what do I do next? I'd never written an original screenplay before. I don't know how you get from one thing to another. I'll just have this thing happen to my character that happened to me and see where it goes. My preconception about screenwriting, about most things, is that you have a plan. You have like a map. You have a strategy, a blueprint. And no, In her case, it was more like a diary, which you were just saying. It was just like, okay, I'll put this in motion and I'll see where it takes me.
Awesome.
Oh, no, so I was just wondering about that because it's kind of like something missing creates this, then you have to find, it's the art of improv, or it's like I heard that scat was born when the music pages were like lost.
Oh, really? Great. That's great.
And so it's great because something, I think that sometimes great art comes about, like it's an act of survival. Like almost you have to lie, like you have to tell a lie right now, like make us believe this story as though your life depended on it. Or if you look at animals, they do the amazing things. It's an act of survival.
The last chapter of the book is the playwright Susan Laurie Porks and the writing of this play, not one of her major plays, but during COVID, she was like everyone else. She was in lockdown. She couldn't do what she was doing. She was finishing a television show on Aretha Franklin and she couldn't finish it. She had other projects that she had to do and she was feeling an enormous amount of despair in her. Her husband got COVID and she was in a great deal of distress and she wrote every day a play. Every day she took 30 minutes and wrote a play and the plays then developed a life of their own. She would write one kind of scene where a ghost would visit and then she would have ghosts visit every fourth day and she was writing about a sort of imaginary television show she was watching and that television show would appear every third day. Suddenly the thing had a dramatic structure and there was a character that was emerging, that was writing these plays, that was, in fact, the protagonist of a play with a family that was sort of like hers. There's a wife and a husband and a child, just as she had. And she decided pretty quickly that she was writing a play. But she had started to write this, just, Mia, to your terms, when I was drowning. I needed it for survival. I needed to create in order to breathe, which is a phrase that she comes back to over and over again. She was able to make productive use out of that same distress that everybody was feeling it during that period and making this play that was kind of remarkable.
Yeah, and you mentioned ghosts and you've written about this too, where artists feel like their work of art takes its own life. And mm-hmm. once you just get it going and they just have this life of their own, and you have ghosts now, or you experience the presence. Do you find them coming into your paintings?
Oh, it's
or your
so
writing?
Funny that you, I'm an unbelievably secular person. And if you look at this book carefully, you'll see how many times I try to dismiss the mystical in order to elevate the hardcore work aspect of the making, not just the sort of visiting by the spirits. By the end of the book, I kind of came over to this idea that mystical forces are in play, even if I still think that the diligence, the labor, is the most important aspect of it. I now acknowledge the ways in which things talk to you. Call them spirits. Call what I call them really is your own subconscious. You're talking to yourself all the time. And as I'm painting, I find myself doing the very same thing that a lot of the artists in the book talked about, which surprised me at the time, which is that the painting tells me what it wants. The painting actually talks to me and it says, okay, you need to make this kind of mark over here. So, okay, I'll do what you want. And I make that kind of mark over there. And of course, it's not a ghost. It's not some spirit, but it's a way to have this dialogue with myself that we've been talking about, ways in which one talks to oneself.
But it's true. I mean, I've had scientists tell me, like Rupert Sheldrake calls it morphic resonance, or this feeling, this thing that, you know it without knowing it. Why do you know it? You just feel it through the generations. I'm not so mystical, but when I was living in Ireland, and I realized later we were living
on it's Ireland.
Graveyard. we were having nightmares. I didn't know that. I was having nightmares. And it was like being pulled into the earth. And then we found out later we're actually on an old burial ground where the church is next door. Yeah. So we are on, yeah. So, I mean, okay. If there's enough collection of the collective, and I think we're energy, and I think it can happen. Without mm-hmm. being mystical, there's something.
Do you find, Mia, do you find some kind of disembodied aspect? There's like voice that's telling you what to do sometimes?
I don't know, but you do a lot when you don't realize, right? Yeah. You're sleepwalking. That's the thing. You're kind mm-hmm. of sleepwalking.
Yeah.
And then it's that thing like, did I do that? I mean, the most I've heard this a lot of times, like, how did we do that? Yeah. And then you have to teach them what they
yes.
did.
Yes, yes.
That's the magic part. That's the best part. When it's play and then you don't realize that at the end of it, you've made this thing and you only have the recording of whatever it is that proves that it happened, because otherwise you wouldn't know because it's a dream.
But I just want to say this for the listener. There's so much rigor that has to happen before the play, that there's so much training you have to have. There's so much strategy you start before the accidents start to happen. Play actually happens. There is just a great deal of work. That's kind of what my book's about.
The work of art is the work. It becomes play, but it's the joy of making the work. But you have to spend the hours. Don't you find that sometimes that these artists were working a long time and they finally talk Lincoln and the Bardo, talk about ghosts, George Saunders, who also came on our show. You could be working a long time and then suddenly it becomes easy or something. It's that you put the hours in. It's not always the most difficult thing that is your art. This is something I've noticed. People think, oh, I thought I was a musician for years, but then I discovered I was a writer. That was just the thing. But I was avoiding all the time. I was writing all these notes about my music. And then it's the thing almost staring in front of them, the simplest thing.
Well, the simple thing is like such an important concept. Yeah. Every story in my book is different. Everyone has a different way of doing things. But there is one thing, there are several things that were in common. But one of those things was the main action was to simplify. The main action was to make the complicated simple. What comes out of your head is just a big mess. And the work is very much figuring out the simplest version of that. That's what makes the work so powerful, is that you're able to find the clear in the complicated.
Yeah, you flick through all the wave bands and then you get that clear signal. I did want to ask you as well, because you're talking about things born of necessity, like you with having deadlines with magazines, or like talking about the things where you just had to go to print, and talk about that momentum of a project that made something happen that was great because you had no choice.
Right. Well, I'll give you a magazine example. You want a magazine example would be like when I was working at the Times and working at the Times Magazine. One Tuesday morning, the towers fell. 9/11, 2001. And the magazine had a 10-day lead time, so that it was a weekly, 10 days old by the time it came out. And we came to work and realized the world had changed. And the entire process, the magazine had been made for 100 and some years, had to be thrown out the window. And we had to make a new magazine in 36 hours that would in some way speak to this very different and scary and interesting world we were now in. Usually a magazine would be made really over months. I mean, if you take all of its aspects, it's a long journey, haul, whatever. So we made a magazine in 36 hours that was in some ways the best magazine I ever made. Because of the urgency of the moment, we made a particular set of decisions. The decision was, we're going to focus just on this day, what happened this day. And that was a fantastic limit. And we're going to bring in all the talent we'd been assembling all these years. And they, because they were all in their own states of agitation, which also was a creative stimulus for them, they were able to create these things overnight that we then worked into a kind of tapestry magazine with these observations, impressions, sensory experiences that were combined with this incredible photography that we'd assembled. And on the cover of the magazine, we found a memorial, which actually came into being, called the Towers of Light, that was just imagined in the last 24 hours. And I just will say that the magazine, out of circumstance and constraint and kind of new supercharged condition, we were able to make as perfect a magazine form as I've ever been associated with in my career.
Yes, I remember it very well. And it had that rawness. You're talking about the vulnerability and images, but like as we're all going through, it just spoke to us, and a dignity to understand. Because I'm really have to, just to see it, to understand and hold still the image too, but to understand that, to have a memorial in a magazine at that time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then that's beautiful because that's the spontaneous. I don't want to keep you too long, but we're also living through, talking about bearing witness, living through difficult times. Yeah. So I'm thinking about the future, because we work a lot with like over 100 universities, and obviously Peyton is one of our participating students, and the next generation is having a difficult time, whether it's climate change or, as we've seen, the education department is gutted.
In motion to be destroyed altogether.
Yeah, so I don't know what the message this sends. I mean, we don't care about the next generation. We won't be around. But, I mean, what are your thoughts on the future? Generally, the future of education, you know, the kind of education that you had in magazines and journalism is not available in the same way now. And who are those important mentors to you? And then what would you like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
Oh, boy. I don't, at the moment, I feel just as scared and discouraged as they all do. So I'm not really in a position to offer hope. But I do feel hope because I do believe in human resilience. And because of that education, I have some sense of history, which is that we have lived through very, very scary periods, scarier than this one, and survived. And I have to hope that we will again. But it's challenging. And I think it's useful. The only thing I would say to young people, because I'm just obsessed with this, is that they have to know the past. They have to actually take some time to understand what it is that got us here. And then I think that they would take less for granted the world that has been built, which has lots of problems, but nevertheless is largely overall a story of progress. And I think a lot of young people that I know just don't, you know a lot about, for whatever reasons, education has failed them. And they don't know a lot about how precious this thing that we now, they only see what's awful about our present, which I understand. But it's also, in many ways, a wonderful story. And they should know that story, both to feel hope and also to know what it is they're fighting for.
Exactly. Well, thank you, Adam Moss, for showing us the importance of the arts, for sharing these insights into the creative act and the work of art, and your commitment to the art of journalism and editing and the power of stories, for helping us understand the human condition. Thank you for adding your voice to the creative process.
Oh, well, thank you, Mia. It's a real pleasure. Thank you to both of you.
The Creative Process Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk and Peyton Desjardins with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producer on this episode were Sophie Garnier and Peyton Desjardins. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Katie Foster. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anadolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you enjoy listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative work to review, just follow us on Instagram @creativeprocesspodcast and send us a DM. Thanks for listening.